ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Grinoid Podcast 14, The Seeds of Doom. I have on the other end of a Skype line a half-vegetable, half-man, Martin.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Not bad, thank you. Not bad. Yourself?
Oh, yes, I'm reasonable.
Oh, you've always struck me as rather unreasonable.
Well, I'm having a reasonable day today, so...
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I caught you then. Okay, Seeds of Doom... Broadcast over January and February in 1976, written by Robert Banks Stewart. And this is during what is considered by many a glory period of Doctor Who's history. It's the Philip Hinchcliffe era when he was producing. Script edited by the Governor, Robert Holmes. And directed by Douglas Dougie Camfield.
Yes, his last Doctor Who, I think, isn't it?
It is, yes. He decided he was getting a little bit too associated with it. He was called the King of Doctor Who at one point, and he decided that was the time to abdicate. Mm. So he didn't do another one after this. This is the last story of season 13, and it comes just after The Brain of Morbius. But it's an interesting bookend to season 13, because it's the same writer, director, and regular cast, and incidental music, as the first story of that season, which was Terror of the Zygons.
Because Zygons was supposed to be the final story of the previous season, wasn't it?
So. It was, yes. So, yes, in a way that would have been sort of symmetrical as well. But anyway, let's get on to the meat and potatoes and vegetables of the Seeds of Doom. Into part one. We're somewhere in Antarctica. There's some stock footage of icebergs, and then a still photo with some snow superimposed over it. And then a quarry near Reigate with fake snow sprayed onto it.
Mm. What do you think of that? I thought they'd done reasonably well, actually.
Not bad at all. And one particularly good thing about all this stuff, particularly outside in Antarctica, but you can also hear it when they're inside the base and stuff like that, is the sound design. There's some really quite convincing... sort of a polar wind sound, which really adds to the atmosphere and helps suspend your disbelief.
Yeah. Throughout the story, there's a couple of dodgy shots with the snow. But mainly, I think it's pretty good. But you then get the model shot of the camp, don't you? Which I think is superb.
Yes, it is excellent. It's designed by Richard Conway, who used to do work for Gerry Anderson in the 60s. One of the big things that they did was trying to make it, you know, look as realistic as possible. And he's done that here by, there's a little moving antenna that's there to measure the wind, presumably. And he's got that going on this model shot, and it all adds to the effect. It looks really good.
Yeah, it does. I'm very impressed, you know, especially for the time. It looks pretty good. So outside, we see Charles Winlett and Derek Moberly sort of digging in the ice. And they find... something, don't they? It's sort of a kind of a big egg-shaped vegetable type thing that they dig out of the snow, and they discuss it a bit, don't they? And then they head back to the camp.
Back in the camp, there's plenty of fake beards, aren't there? Postiche, I believe it's called in theatrical terms, the fake wigs and beards.
Yeah, they're cracking, aren't they?
Yeah, some are slightly more fake than others. Winlett and Moberly meet up with John Stevenson, who's the base botanist. He identifies what they've found as vegetable-based. And because they found it in the ninth layer of the permafrost, they estimate it's been buried there in the ice for about 20,000 years. And we have a closer look at this pod. And they're using salt on top of it to make it look like snow, because obviously that doesn't melt under studio lights. But it looks pretty convincing.
While they're talking, Stevenson kind of gets a bit distracted, doesn't he? He sort of reaches out towards the pod, and the others wonder what he's doing. He seems a bit almost in a trance. He says he can feel something. He thinks it might be alive. The other two suggest that, you know, he needs a drink or something like that, doesn't he? And they suggest they go off for a game of cards.
Yeah, that's right. The idea of it being tropical is not valid, because at the time it was buried... Antarctica had ceased to be tropical, so it makes you start wondering where exactly it's come from. And Stevenson, thinking it's alive, means that, you know, they start getting a bit sort of concerned about it, and he says he's going to transmit some pictures of the pod to London. Mm. As we said in the Spearhead from Space podcast, what they do here is quite similar to that. Stevenson says he's going to transmit pictures of the pod to London. Then we go to London, with people looking at pictures of the pod. So it gives it that sort of pacey feel that we were talking about in the Spirit from Space podcast when they use that same kind of approach there.
That's right. You get that quite a lot in this story, don't you? Quick cuts from to move it on. So we're suddenly in London, in the World Ecology Bureau, and it's the office of a Richard Dunbar. And he's there with the doctor, who's sitting playing with his yo-yo, isn't he?
that's not a euphemism. He's a yo-yo.
Yeah. And they're talking about the pod, aren't they? Dunbar doesn't think that the doctor's going to be able to help him. But his boss, Sir Colin Thackeray, has insisted that he show the doctor the photos of the pod. The doctor tells Dunbar that he can sit down, and then he takes a seat himself and just sticks his feet on Dunbar's desk, doesn't he?
Yeah, this is all, I think, part of the problem why Dunbar thinks the doctor can't help. He's sitting there with a yo-yo. He's horribly cheeky, and he is, you know, very rude, isn't he, just sitting in the chair, whacking his feet on his desk. He doesn't look like a scientific advisor, does he?
No, that's right.
The doctor examines the pictures and asks if they've considered the idea that the pod could actually be extraterrestrial rather than an extinct species, which is, you know, the theory they're working on.
And he, still looking at the photos, he says that they could actually be sitting on a ticking bomb, doesn't he? Mm. Which obviously suggests that he recognises what this pod is. Dunbar tells the doctor that Thackeray has a daily video link to the Antarctic lab. So the doctor says to warn the scientists not to touch the pod, and he's going to go down there immediately. Dunbar sort of says, well, you're going to go right now. He goes, and he takes a toothbrush out of his pocket, doesn't he? He says, yeah, why not? I've got my toothbrush.
That's interesting, because apparently at that time, Tom Baker used to go everywhere with his toothbrush because he was, shall we say, making the most of his celebrity status at this point. So he never knew quite where he'd be the next morning. So he used to carry a toothbrush, so that was a kind of in-joke.
Yeah. As he leaves, you know, he said, sort of thing about the toothbrush, and he says, remember, no touch pod.
Could be dangerous.
And he sort of goes out, and Thackeray picks up the phone, and he says, that chap you called in from UNIT, is he quite sane?
Good question. So back at the Antarctic base, Stevenson discovers that the pod is growing larger. It's grown 5 centimetres in diameter since that morning, and he believes it's absorbing the ultraviolet radiation. He's got a lamp pointing at it. Wouldn't it remind Stevenson that the orders from London are to leave it alone until the doctor arrives the next day? But Stevenson just thinks the doctor would be some crank that Thackeray wants to foist on them, and he's not going to know any more about it than they do. He starts getting sort of quite territorial about it. He feels that, you know, it's their sort of revolutionary discovery. And it's up to them what they want to do with it.
I thought at this point that it was going to pan out slightly differently, because I thought maybe this pod had got some influence over Stevenson.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, that doesn't happen, but that was the impression I got as I was watching it. But
that's a good point, because it's not really his character to be like that, as we find later. So maybe it's a little kind of red herring thrown in there just to keep the viewers guessing. Mm.
We then cut to this house. It's Athelhampton House in Dorset, is where it was actually filmed. And it's kind of like a big kind of country home, isn't it? And Dunbar arrives, and it turns out to be the country home of millionaire Harrison Chase. And Dunbar's shown in and announced by Chase's butler, whose name's Hargreaves. And Chase immediately kind of puts Dunbar on the back foot, doesn't he? Because he asks what the World Ecology Bureau is doing about the abuse of shrubs and trees via bonsai. Mm. And Dunbar's a bit sort of taken aback by that. Chase is quite an interesting character from the start, isn't he? He's wearing gloves. When we first see him, he's surrounded by all these plants, isn't he? In this sort of big room in his house. He's quite a striking character.
Yeah, he's somewhat camp, isn't he?
Yes.
But it's camp but menacing, which is a tricky one to pull off. Mm. He's got a 70s three-piece suit, isn't he? And as you say, he's always in these black leather gloves. You can tell he's quite fanatical about plants, can't you? Because he's describing what they do with bonsai. He's using words like mutilation and torture, isn't he? Which are not usually used when referring to the plant kingdom.
Yes, so it's not all there from the start, I don't think. But anyway, Dunbar shows him the photo of this pod that's been found, and explains that, you know, where it was found, and that it might be from outer space. And of course, Chase is instantly interested. He's trying to get out of Dunbar where it actually is, you know, where exactly in the Antarctic was it found. And Dunbar's sort of saying that he'll tell him where it is if he gives him money for it. Dunbar also mentions that it might still be viable and able to germinate. And Chase is, you know, he clearly wants to get his hands on this thing.
So at this point, Chase calls for one of his men, Scorby, to come in. And when Scorby arrives, he's a very familiar actor to many people in Britain. It's John Challis, who plays Boycie in a long-running sitcom, Only Fools and Horses. He's a sort of dodgy car dealer, isn't he? Mm. Oh, come on, Marlene. Del, you smell like a vegetarian's fart. Yes.
Et cetera, et cetera.
So it's quite a joy to see him arrive. And he turns out to actually be very good in this story, but more of that later. Anyway, Chase gives him an assignment, and he tells him to take Mr. Keeler along with him.
Indeed. Meanwhile, back in the Antarctic, Winlet is having a bit of a doze by this pod, isn't he?
Could be dangerous.
It could be very dangerous, as we find out shortly. He kind of comes around a bit and he drinks some coffee that's on the sort of the desk in front of him. I should point out that the pod is kind of on this desk as well, not very far from him, is it? Anyway, the coffee doesn't seem to kick in very quickly, so he basically falls asleep. And then we get this quite impressive shot of the pod opening, and this kind of frond comes out, doesn't it, and touches on his arm, and appears to kind of sting it, doesn't it? Because he instantly wakes up and starts crying out and falls to the ground with it.
Yeah, it's a great effect, isn't it? It's actually done in reverse, isn't it? They lay the sort of tentacle prop on his arm and then drag it back very quickly under the table where the pod is at the top of but in reverse. It looks really good, doesn't it?
Oh, I think it's very impressive. A lot of the effects in this story are very good, I think. But anyway, the other two kind of hear his cry. They're in another room in the base, and they sort of come rushing in. They find him, and he's on the floor, and they turn him over, and his face is all green, isn't it? He's obviously become infected by this plant.
Yes, in the script he's described as looking like he's gone mouldy.
He does look a bit mouldy. He looks more like he's got kind of green jam on his face, to be honest. But
yes. Yeah.
Can you get green jam?
Gooseberry, perhaps?
Maybe it's more like a green tomato chutney or something.
Yeah, perhaps. Anyway, they they decide to send a message to London to inform Dunbar and Sir Colin what's happened. But with the bad weather, it turns out it will take a few days for the medical team to reach them at the base. An interesting point is it's the first time we see Sir Colin Thackeray, and it turns out that the actor is Michael Barrington, who plays the highly ineffectual governor from Slade Prison in Porridge, which is a long-running prison-based sitcom with Ronnie Barker.
Yeah, Dunbar also mentions that the people from UNIT should be arriving at the base any time now as well.
Mm.
And sure enough, we go back to the base where a helicopter is kind of landing, isn't it? This again is a model shot, isn't it?
Mm.
And again, it's done really well. You see it coming down to land in all this snow, which probably helps to disguise the fact that there's probably a wire somewhere.
Yes.
But I thought it was very impressive. And
yeah, me too.
Basically, it drops the Doctor and Sarah off and then departs, doesn't it, straight away.
Mm.
And Derek has come out to greet them.
Yes, Derek Moberly. This character is played by Michael McStay. At this point, because it's shot out of order, at this point, the actor had recently been in a car crash, and he couldn't speak or move very well at this point. So he's very, as you'd expect out when he's going outside in the Antarctic, he's very wrapped up, but his voice is very hoarse.
Mm.
An interesting point about this actor, he was actually in the running to replace Sean Connery as James Bond.
Blimey.
Before it went to George Lazenby.
Well, I never.
And nor do I.
He greets the Doctor and Sarah, and he says that he was expecting someone much older. The Doctor says, I'm only 749, used to be even younger.
there's a slightly embarrassed pause afterwards.
Yeah. And then Sarah introduces herself as the young Doctor's assistant. And they make their way inside, don't they? And he says that there's normally about a dozen of them living in this base, but the others are actually on a mission somewhere else, aren't they?
They're at South Bend measuring the ice cap.
That's right. So there's only three of them at the base. Sarah sort of says, asking about how they can stand the weather. And they say, sometimes it even gets up to 10 below freezing.
Yeah.
The doctor, of course, is still dressed in his normal attire, isn't he? Mobley is all wrapped up, as is Sarah, but the doctor's just got his normal clothes on.
Mobley asks him how he can stand the cold. One of the quite a number of rude outbursts in this story.
Yeah.
The doctor says, I haven't come 10,000 miles to discuss the weather.
Yeah, and he asks to see the sick man straight away. In they go, and Charles has now changed quite a bit, hasn't he? His body temperature apparently is now dropping rapidly. It's now at 46, and his pulse rate is 18 per minute. John basically says, you know, I'm no expert, but he should be dead, shouldn't he?
Sounds a bit like Star Trek to me.
Yeah.
According to these readings, Jim, he should be dead.
The doctor pulls back the sheet from Charles to show, you know, and you see the top half of his body, and it's now all kind of green. It's like branches, isn't it, and stuff like that, it appears to be.
It's really good makeup, I think, or costume, whatever it is. At this point, I suppose it's costume in the lower half. Mm. This growth is accelerating. The doctor says by the time the medical team arrives, it may be too late for Winlet. So it's fairly clear the doctor has an idea of what the pod might be and what is happening to Charles Winlet.
Mm, exactly. Sarah's drinking some tea to try and warm up. She's asking Derek about the pod. But then this kind of a radio alarm goes off, doesn't it? There's kind of this flashing blue light on the wall, and Derek goes off to answer it. Meanwhile, the doctor's asking John where the lab is. He's quite angry that things have moved on so quickly, isn't he?
Derek Mobley takes a radio call from Mike Wilson, who's part of their team who've gone to South Bend. They tell him the medical team's actually turned back because of whiteout conditions and their snowcat's fallen into a crevasse. So the help that was going to come too late isn't coming at all. The doctor says Winlet's condition is more serious and complicated than just life or death. He's actually changing form. So the doctor wants to get a blood sample from Winlet. And he wants to see the pod and cause all the problems. And he just leans his face into John Stevenson and says, pod, rather rudely.
Yeah. John shows the doctor the pod, which is obviously now an empty kind of shell, isn't it? And the doctor sort of wonders why it actually opened. And John sort of says that that's probably his fault because he put it under a lamp and it started to grow. The doctor's response is quite shocking, really, isn't it? He says, Mr. Stevenson, what you've done could result in the total destruction of all life on this planet.
Stevenson should just go, oops. But anyway, Derek Mobley does get a sample of blood from Winlet, which superficially does look like human blood. Meanwhile, outside the base, the doctor, still in his hat and scarf and nothing else, is digging at the ice, stroke polystyrene.
And
the
scarf and nothing else?
Well, under those clothes, there's nothing else.
Oh, I see.
Anyway, he finds another pod, horrifyingly. Mm. Stevenson asks if there are like to be any more down there. The doctor shakes his head and says the pods travel in pairs like policemen.
Anyway, they head back in and they... Oh, no, he says that they, you know, they should take the pods into custody and put them in the freezer. Sarah makes a quip about, you know, who sold the freezer to him, an Eskimo.
Yeah, it's one of a number of feeble jokes Sarah makes throughout the story.
By this stage, Winner is almost unrecognisable, isn't he? He's starting to turn into some sort of hideous monster. The doctor is looking at the blood sample, and he gets John to have a look as well. And John's quite shocked to find that they are schizophytes, the smallest known organisms, which are plant bacteria. Mm. So the doctor sort of says that Winlet's blood is turning into vegetable soup.
Yeah, all the blood platelets have gone as well. Mm. Just then they hear the sound of engines, and Derek Mobley and John Stevenson get topped up and go out to meet what they presume is a medical team. Meanwhile, the doctor tells Sarah that Winlet is turning into a crinoid, which is the first time we hear that mentioned. It's a kind of galactic weed that settles on planets and eats the animal life there. He doesn't himself know exactly how crinoids travel between the stars. He conjectures that their planet might be sort of geologically turbulent. and when there are surface explosions, they send matter shooting to space, and that's how the pods get sent out into space.
John and Derek, meanwhile, are bringing in two men who have obviously just arrived, and Sarah kind of helps them to sit them down, and they're given some tea, aren't they? The two men say that they're flying a private plane, and then they've got lost. The men turn out to be Scorby, who we've seen, and the other chap is Keeler. You know, two of Chase's men have been sent to get this pod. But obviously they're pretending that that's not the case.
Yes.
The doctor basically asks John to take him out to have another look at the patient, and they leave, I assume, with Sarah, though you don't actually see her leave the room. But as soon as they're gone, Scorby and Keeler start having a conversation. You know, Keeler's wondering whether they swallowed the story, but Scorby sort of says, well, you know, it doesn't really matter, there's nothing they could do anyway.
Yeah, it's a slightly fanciful story, isn't it? They're flying a private plane over the Antarctic, and got lost, and landed when they saw the lights of the base. But yeah. They do, you know, the base does seem to have swallowed the story. But Keeler is very nervous about the plan, isn't he? Meanwhile, Winlet's transformation is nearly complete. The doctor, oddly, I thought, suggests that if they amputate the arm where the infection started, it might stop the spread of the infection. Although it's clear that most of his body, or if not all, is already covered in the green stuff.
Yeah.
But even if it doesn't work, it might buy them some time. I suppose that is the most concentrated part of the crinoid matter. But then they come to a rather nasty choice about who's going to do the amputation. The doctor is not a doctor of medicine, as Sarah declares. Stevenson is a botanist, but Moberly is a zoologist and therefore the most qualified. And there's an interesting line the doctor comes up with. He says, "You must help yourselves." Mm. It's just a little kind of throwback to, you know, the Time Lord diktats of not interfering. But apparently Tom Baker added that line himself. It wasn't in the script.
Yeah, and it does make him very alien, doesn't it?
Mm.
It's quite chilling, really, with the way he delivers it as well.
It is, yeah, because you don't really see him say that kind of stuff so baldly as that, do you? He might try and get people to help themselves, and he doesn't tend to just tell them that.
Mm. Anyway, they manage to kind of convince Derek that he's got to do it. John says that there's a medical kit in the lab, and so they sort of head off to get that, don't they?
It's a good scene for Sarah, I think, this one, because she is the one that persuades Derek Moberly to do it, really, and she puts in a very good performance, I think.
Yeah.
As she does in a number of places in this story.
And as they leave, Winlet kind of sits up, doesn't he? You see his face, which is now almost completely covered by sort of vegetation.
Yeah, you get the feeling that he's aware that they want to chop bits off him. Mm. He's got a sort of look, looks quite scared, doesn't he?
He does. So in the sort of sick bay area, outside the sick bay area, they're preparing the things they're going to need for this this operation. So they've got some antiseptic and some equipment, etc. And Derek sort of has it on a tray and he takes it out back towards the sick bay. But as he goes out into the hall, Winlet is up out of bed, isn't he? And he's kind of shuffling near the wall. Derek puts down the tray and sort of approaches him, doesn't he, and sort of says, what are you doing out of bed, child? And as he goes towards him, the crinoid stroke Winlet attacks him and basically puts his arms around his neck. It's really just sort of shoulders, actually, isn't it? And sort of bears him to the ground. And Derek has this kind of horrible look on his face as the credits come up and the theme tune starts.
Yeah, it's a slightly odd choice from the actor, I think, isn't it? Because it's being, I guess, strangled, isn't it? Although, as you say, it looks a bit more around the shoulders, really, rather than around the throat. But he kind of falls to the floor with his eyes open, and you think, all right, he's going to die with his eyes open. And then he shuts them a little bit afterwards.
Yeah, I didn't think quite well. Apparently, this was the second take. The first take apparently was too scary. Mm. So they redid it, and I don't think they did it particularly well in the end.
No.
This is a joke.
Yeah, you get the general idea of what's happening. But, interestingly, they cast John Gleeson, not John Leeson of K9 fame, but John Gleeson as Charles Winlet before the part when he has to become the crinoid, because apparently he had a strange hip problem which made him walk in a quite distinctive and odd way. And Douglas Camfield wanted the the taken over, wouldn't let to shuffle around like this, so that's how he got the part.
I thought actually that once he is up and about, he instantly reminded me of Noah from Ark in Space, without the bubble wrap.
Yes.
But it's a very similar idea as well, isn't it? You know, the body horror being taken over by another creature kind of taking over the human body.
Yeah, bit by bit. Yeah, I think this is the next time it happens, isn't it, after Ark in Space? I can't think of it happening quite in the same way between there and now.
Mm.
But it's always good stuff, and it's you're always intrigued to see how far he's gone the next time you see the character. It's a good sort of suspenseful thing as well, isn't it?
So we're into part two now, and Winlet, having killed off Derek, he goes outside. You see him open the door to the exterior, and he goes out, and snow blows in.
Meanwhile, Scorby has found the base's rifle. It looks like they've only got one, and he picks it up and sabotages it so it can't be used against them. His companion, Keeler, is getting more and more nervous, and I think it's a really good performance here from the actor, Mark Jones. He starts to shout at Scorby in frustration, doesn't he? And then shushes himself as he's doing it.
Yeah.
And it's an excellent sort of nervous tick sort of performance.
Yeah.
And it really, really adds to the scene, I think.
So.
But Keeler thought that all they were going to do was have a look at the pod and report back to Chase, because Keeler is a botanist. Chase is a pet botanist. And but Scorby announces the plan is to basically kill all the others, take the pod and fly back and give it to Chase. Keeler balks at this idea, but Scorby starts getting heavy and warns him that there could easily be one more among the dead, which is a nice sort of threatening scene.
Yeah, and he points the rifle at him as well, doesn't he?
Yes, and actually, well, I mean, he's disabled, isn't he, but he clicks it at him just to give him the point, pulls the trigger.
Meanwhile, Sarah has found Derek's body in the corridor, and she goes back and tells the doctor and John Stevenson.
There's a nice sort of three-stage close-up of Derek's face, isn't there, when she sees him?
Yeah.
And the incidental music sort of hits each close-up very effectively.
Yeah. And they find that Winlet's gone, and this is the point where they keep referring to him as Winlet, don't they? And the doctor gets very annoyed. He says, "Not Winlet anymore. He's a crinoid. He's an alien, not of this world." And that his mind will have been taken over by this crinoid. There's going to be a short transition period before it turns into a fully grown crinoid. He refers to it being a grotesque parody of the human form, doesn't he?
Mm, it does, yeah. He decides that they must basically destroy him. So they gather their things to go out and search for the crinoid, and they take the rifle, obviously not realising it's been sabotaged. When they leave, Scorby and Keeler, of course, are free to have a look around the base to try and find the pod.
Back at Chase's mansion, Dunbar is reporting there's been some trouble at the base and that there's been some sort of viral infection. Chase says that he's sent his most efficient man there to acquire the pod, which surprises Dunbar, but he says that, you know, once the pod's back in England, it's going to be better protected than the crown jewel, so it's going to be far easier to get it while it's still out, you know, in Antarctica. Dunbar wants his role in this affair kept secret. You know, he wants anonymity. And Chase says that he, not to worry, he always protects his employees. And this is where we find out from Dunbar, you know, that he took up this career hoping to reach the top, but he's in time-serving non-entities promoted over his head. He wants a large amount of money as a recompense because of that.
Sure enough, Chase gets him an attaché case full of readies, doesn't
he? Yeah.
Yes, back in Antarctica, the crinoid, which at this stage is basically a resprayed Axon, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
The claws of Axon. It's a kind of not fully formed axon, isn't it? Because the axons are in different stages. Please refer to our podcast about the claws of axons. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the second to last stage before it gets all sort of rooty and spaghetti man. Mm-hmm. And but it looks good, doesn't it? It does look like sort of plant matter all sort of stuck together in humanoid form.
Yeah.
And this crinoid finds the generator hut, which is built a distance from the base because they're using a new fuel cell system, which I guess they can't rely on the safety of it 100%. This is one of the only sort of disappointing shots here, I think. The kind of nasty sort of CSO shot with scenery and snow superimposed as you see a crinoid in the distance sort of deciding where to go. And then you see the model of the generator, which is not bad.
Yeah. Is like, as I say, there's only one or two dodgy CSO shots.
Yeah,
there was one just there. Meanwhile, back at the base, Keela and Scorby are desperately trying to find this pod, and they're basically, well, it's mainly Scorby who's kind of knocking things off all the shelves and smashing stuff up, isn't he? And in fact, Keela tells him to be careful with, you know, that it's quite expensive equipment. Scorby says, well, they're not going to have any use for it. Just, you know, gratuitously smashes something on the floor, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But at this stage, the radio kicks into life, and it's South Bend calling Derek, aren't they? And Scorby, you know, Keela's quite scared about this, but Scorby just goes over and pretends to be Derek. And he tries to put them off by saying that, you know, everything's sorted now. They no longer need the medical team. But then the voice at the other end sort of says, is that you, Derek? Are you sure that's Derek? And Scorby just sort of pulls the wire out of the radio and, you know, cuts them off.
Yeah, so that ends that problem.
But they do say that the weather is clearing their end, which is quite significant a bit later, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, that's right. Meanwhile, the Dr. Sarah and John Stevenson have entered the generator hut. Meanwhile, again, Keela finds the open pod. And realised that it must have germinated, and that whatever was inside is gone or is kind of finished, basically. And the plant is doing something else. Scorby realises that Chase wants the actual plant that emerged from the pod rather than this empty pod, so he sets out to look for that.
Back in the generator hut, the doctor is reminding Stevenson that Winlet no longer exists, and he actually gets very angry at this point, doesn't he? Because both Stevenson and Sarah keep calling him Winlet. Actually, there's quite a few scenes in this where the Doctor sort of almost loses it, doesn't he? Shouts a lot, doesn't he, in this story?
Yeah, he's quite an angry soldier at this point.
They all hope that the second pod is safe and that the crinoid is basically frozen out in the snow somewhere. Of course, it's not. And as the three of them head back to the base, you see the crinoid kind of watching them. And, you know, it's obviously eyed up this hut.
Yes. And meanwhile, back at the base, Scorby and Keela are still trying to find whatever came out of the pod. And they find Derek Mobley's body in the sick bay. He's under a kind of shroud, isn't he? And Michael McStay, the actor, is apparently using shallow breathing techniques so that you can't see the shroud rising up and down with his breathing. And they're quite horrified at what's happened to him, aren't they?
Yeah. The crinoid is trying to get into the hut, isn't it? While the Dr. Sarah and Stevenson sort of get back to the camp. Stevenson goes off to check on something while the Doctor and Sarah go in. And once inside, Scorby calls out for them to come into the room where Derek's body is. And of course, as they go in there, Scorby sort of shows his true colours and he's pointing the gun at them.
There's a great bit here where the Doctor's facing towards Derek's body on the bed, and Scorby tells him to turn around. So basically, the Doctor turns around 360 degrees back to pointing in the bed.
Yes.
And the Doctor spends quite a lot of time in the story winding Scorby up, or beating Scorby up, in fact. But at this point, he's just winding him up. And then, to add insult to injury, Scorby tells the Doctor to start talking. So the Doctor does start talking, but he chooses to talk about Mozart. It really winds Scorby up.
Yeah. Then he says, what happened to Derek? And the Doctor says, oh, he died. And Scorby, by this point, is getting fairly peed off with him, isn't he? Actually, Keela asks him how did he die? The Doctor and Sarah then, between them, sort of explain what happened. The Doctor says that, you know, he's now a monster, and there's a monster outside the camp, that they should advise them that they should lock all the doors and windows, because the thing wants food and warmth. There's only one place it can find it, which is there in the camp. But it actually cuts back to the generator hut, doesn't it, where the creature is now inside, isn't it? So it's found its warmth there.
Yes, and it looks a little perkier, doesn't it, after getting some warmth off the generator. And, you know, it looks like it's ready for an action again. Scorby and Keela have taken Dr. and Sarah to the bunk room, and Keela's tied them up. Scorby wants to know where the plant is, but the doctor's just continuing to be facetious, and Scorby's just about to hit him, basically, when John Stevenson turns up. He sees Scorby holding a gun and tries to shoot him, but obviously he finds that his rifle is useless, as Scorby disabled it earlier, and he's put with the others. Unfortunately, he manages to let slip that there is a second pod.
Yes, he does. And then Scorby points the gun at the doctor and then at Stevenson to try to get them to tell him where the pod is. And then finally points it at Sarah and says, you know, and this time I will fire. So the doctor reluctantly tells him where it is, which is basically in one of the freezers, isn't it?
Scorby gives Keela the gun, which he rather nervously points at the three captives. The doctor tells him, don't worry, we won't hurt you.
Yeah.
Scorby's taken Stevenson away, and he's forced him to take the second pod out of the freezer. And he says it's going to go on a little journey, so it needs to be kept cool. Stevenson said it's not dangerous if it's kept cool, so he has to provide a thermal container to keep it cool so it doesn't do anything on the journey home. Scorby then realizes about all the lighting and electricity on the base, and asks Stevenson where it all comes from, and Stevenson tells him about the generator hut, and Scorby wonders whether the creature may be there, but Stevenson said they've already looked there. But it turns out it gives Scorby another idea.
Yes. The doctor and Sarah, meanwhile, are trying to reason with Keela. I think the doctor says to him, you know, you don't like violence, do you, Keela? He's looking very nervous. He's got his arms stretched out, pointing the gun at them, isn't he? But he looks like he's going to wet himself any minute. And they suggest that their only hope for all of them is that he sets them free so that they can help to fight against the crinoid together. But, of course, at this point, Scorby comes back in with Stevenson, and he gets Keela to tie Stevenson up.
Yeah, a nice bit here is that we know that Arnold Keela is a quiet and unassuming botanist and doesn't like all this stuff. As he's tying up Stevenson, he actually says, excuse me, to him, which is a nice touch.
Yeah. Keela says to Scorby, "What, you know, what are you going to do with them? Are you going to shoot them?" But Scorby says, no, he's got a better idea. And he actually grabs hold of Sarah and sort of drags her out of the room. The doctor's shouting after him, you know, shouting out his name, but he manages to get her outside, and he's trying to get her to tell him where the hut is. Sarah's pretending she doesn't know where it is, but I think Stevenson had already given the game away, that said they'd been there about an hour ago. So Scorby forces her to take him there.
At the hut, Scorby plants a bomb, which is going to basically cause a chain reaction which will end up blowing up the base, so he doesn't need to dig his big hole and put all the bodies in. He can destroy all the evidence of, you know, their activities with one bomb.
The doctor and Stevenson are trying desperately to get themselves untied, and then the doctor has an idea. There's these kind of gas lamps hanging from the ceiling, aren't there? And he manages to knock one off its hook onto the floor, and of course the glass smashes, and he manages to get a bit of the broken glass, and he uses it to start to cut Stevenson's rope to free him.
Meanwhile, back at the generator hut, Keela's getting cold feet about this plan to blow everyone up, and tries to stop Scorby, rather ineffectually tries to punch him, but Scorby is a bit of a hard man and just basically stops him and boots him out of the hut.
Yes, he sets this bomb, doesn't he? And he says that it's going to blow the camp to smithereens. And they've got about 10 minutes or so, doesn't he? And then they leave the hut, leaving Sarah tied up inside. But meanwhile, the doctor's managed to untie himself and Stevenson, and he asks him, he gets Stevenson to call South Bend to get them to send the team, after all. He goes outside to try and find Sarah, doesn't he? He's calling out to her. Meanwhile, we see the crinoid enter the base. I think that bit's slightly, the cut's too quick there, because you see the Doctor go outside through the same door that the crinoid goes in.
So he almost bumped into him.
Yeah, you think that, how did he manage not to see him? Anyway, the crinoid goes inside and he finds Stevenson, who's in the process of calling South Bend, and it kills him, doesn't it? And he lets out quite a horrific scream, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And then things happen rather quickly in the lead up to the cliffhanger. The Doctor outside sees Scorby and Keeler's plane taking off. It's a bit of Arctic stock footage, isn't it? He runs to the generator where Sarah's tied up. She tells him about the bomb, but then the crinoid turns up at the generator hut. So he's making good speed between the hut and the base. They manage to evade the crinoid, get out the door and lock the crinoid in. And then you see them running away. And the bomb goes off, the hut explodes, and then there's a really nice model shot of the base, basically the chain reaction happening, and a series of explosions from the buildings furthest from a camera working the way towards the camera. It looks really, really good, doesn't it?
I think it looks fantastic. I'm really impressed by it. I think it's a great episode ending. The only thing, the lead up, you keep seeing the shot of the countdown, don't you? I think real time seems to be going slower than the countdown.
That's often the case, isn't it? Yeah. One other point about this cliffhanger, I thought it might be slightly more effective in terms of the Doctor and Sarah being in peril if you didn't have the shots of them running away from the hut, if you didn't realise they'd got any distance from it. I think when you saw it exploding, that would have been more, you know, might be worried more about what's happened to them, as it is the base exploded and the crinoid's being destroyed in the hut. So as it is, that isn't quite so much of an exciting cliffhanger as it could have been. But apparently they'd already cut two shots of the Doctor and Sarah running away, so there was only one left, but I still think you probably could have done without that one.
I suppose so. I mean, I think you're being a bit harsh, but I still think it's superb ending, mainly because this explosion's so good.
Yes.
But, yeah, maybe if the shot of them running it had, you know, if you could still see the hut behind them or something, it would have been maybe been perfect. But
yeah, as it is, it looks like they're some distance away, doesn't it?
Which, of course, they are, as we find out the following week.
Ooh, yes.
They're far enough away to, you know, they're probably caught a little bit by the blast, but it just kind of knocks them out. And we see a snow cat, like Snowmobile thing, turn up with some of the people from South Bend, and they find Sarah, don't they, in the snow. One of them says he's a doctor, Dr. Chester, and he's trying to have a look at Sarah, but she's hysterical, trying to find the doctor, isn't she? And she's yelling out his name, and she starts kind of running around trying to find him, and they find him face down in the snow a little further away, and they kind of turn him over, and Sarah says, oh, it's good he's alive, and he opens his eyes and says, good morning.
Yeah, the big grin.
Yeah.
Apparently at this point he was scripted to receive a tot of whiskey from Dr. Chester. But Tom Baker was very conscious about his place as a children's hero in the role of the Doctor, and he decided it's better for the kids not to see him drinking anything alcoholic.
I bet he did drink it though, just not on camera.
Yeah, he probably had the whole bottle and asked for more.
Yeah, demanded more.
Meanwhile, Scorby and Keeler are back with Chase, with the second pod in hand. Dunbar also turns up. He's angered about how far Chase has gone to get hold of this pod, and he's heard about the whole base being destroyed. And he warns Chase that despite all that, the Doctor and Sarah are still alive, and he knows that because he's scheduled to meet with Sir Colin and the Doctor and Sarah within 2 hours.
There's a nice kind of, I'll say nice, a good line from Chase here when sort of Scorby is telling him about the infected man and the fact that there were two pods, and he reports that everybody was killed. Chase says, oh, that's a pity. I could have had two pods. Callous approach.
A lovely chap.
Then we go back to Sir Colin's office, and the Doctor is he picks up this chair, doesn't he, and sort of carries it and puts it down, then almost sits in it, and then decides he's going to stand up anyway, doesn't he?
Yeah.
A little piece of kind of Tom Baker tomfoolery.
Yes.
And as, you know, as Colin sort of says, why would these fanatics go to such lengths? And then I said, oh, greed, the usual reason why people do things. He refers to greed as being the most dangerous impulse in the universe. Sarah is saying that it was all organised right down to the last detail. And the doctor thinks that the men that were there, they're only stooges working for somebody else. You know, somebody more crazy. He obviously had a bit of a premonition there, didn't he?
Yeah, you got that one right.
But he says what's more upsetting is the fact that the discovery of the pod had only been reported to Sir Colin's department. Sir Colin's quite upset at him suggesting that somebody within his own bureau has leaked the information. And the doctor sort of says, well, you know, why not? They've probably done it for money. You don't think that hired thieves and murderers work for love? And he says that they need to do something. And the doctor believes that the pod is still in the country. The doctor also says that if they don't find the pod, it's going to be the end of everything, even Sir Colin's pension. So, yeah, they eventually kind of convince them that it is quite serious and that they need to help. So, you know, Sir Colin says that they can have full access to everything within the bureau. And Dunbar says that he'll organise whatever the doctor needs. And the doctor says, well, you know, the first thing I want to do is just to go to the Botanic Institute.
Yes. So they, a driver and a car is arranged for them as they leave the building, which is actually BBC TV television centre that they use next door. A driver in a Daimler comes up and claims, you know, to be their lift, and the doctor and Sarah get on board. But during the journey, the driver stops the car somewhere in the countryside near a sort of quarry. And he orders them out at gunpoint. As they exit, the doctor manages to sort of grab the driver through the open window of the open door and to kind of knock the driver over, and both he and Sarah run for it. And then there's quite a sort of action-packed few scenes, isn't there, here? The driver, who's actually a stuntman, Alan Chunce, who actually gets a bit of dialogue here when he orders them out, he runs through this sort of quarry after them. Sarah ducks down and says, come on, cloth eyes, are you blind? Over here. I've never heard the phrase cloth eyes.
Cloth ears, yeah, but not cloth eyes.
It's a strange one. But that's the old trick, isn't it, where someone very purposefully distracts somebody. I'm always amazed that anyone ever falls for it, because it always means, you know, something else is planned for them. But anyway, he sort of heads in her direction, and basically with, you know, a fair amount of teamwork and diversionary tactics, the doctor manages to jump the driver and quite viciously punches him out.
Yeah. It's the first of many violent moments for the doctor in this, isn't it?
But yes.
You don't, you know, you see the fist swing, but you don't actually see it connect. So.
No, maybe not. Mm.
Anyway, they run back to the limo, don't they, and they start kind of searching it to see if they can find something that's going to give them a clue as to where, you know, where to go next. And Sarah finds in the boot of the limo a painting by Amelia Ducard, or Duckett, as the doctor likes to call her.
Yes.
It's a kind of a painting of a flower, isn't it? Sarah knows who this Amelia Ducard is. She's one of the world's leading flower artists. So they head off to see her, see if they get anything out of her.
Yes, and they find her, and she's a mad, sort of cross-eyed old bat, isn't she? Basically, played by Sylvia Coleridge, who's sort of specialised in playing mad, cross-eyed old bats.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if she's actually cross-eyed in real life, or whether she just does it.
It's a party piece. Yeah. And they basically tell her they've found... you know, the picture and all this kind of stuff. And then there's a little play on Oscar Wilde's Importance of Being Earnest, isn't there? Where there's a line about a handbag. In this case, she says, a car boot. And the doctor says, yes, a Daimler car boot. And then she says, the car is a material. Which is basically roughly what Lady Bracknell says in The Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah, that's another quite amusing bit where they're asking about the painting. So sort of who painted it? And there's another one on an easel, isn't there, that she's obviously working on. And she goes, well, nobody, I haven't finished it yet. Sarah has to kind of bring her back to the point that, you know, they're talking about this one that they just brought in.
Yes, obviously. Eccentric, and her mind is wandering.
Yeah, and she's, throughout this scene, she's smoking a cigar. And she, Anyway, she eventually remembers the name of the man that bought it from her, and it was Harrison Chase, the millionaire. And she said, "Good Lord, he never paid me," which felt like a bit of a throwaway line at the time, but it's actually quite important, as we find out later.
Yeah, it brings her back into the story, doesn't it? Keeler is working on the pod in one of Chase's laboratories. He's trying to convince Chase to stop the experiments because, you know, he's aware of what happened to Winlet back at the Antarctic base. But Chase is having none of this, and he orders him to inject the pod with fixed nitrogen. At that point, Dunbar calls Chase's lab, informing Chase that his chauffeur is in hospital. So the doc's punch was obviously pretty effective.
Maybe he knocked one of his teeth out or something.
Yes, yes. Maybe he needs his nose reset.
Sarah and the doctor, meanwhile, arrive at Chase's house in the limo, and they kind of pull up outside the gates, don't they? And the doctor puts on the chauffeur's hat and coat. He then proceeds into the grounds. He sort of beeps the horn, and the guard kind of lets him in. And they drive past at quite some speed, actually, don't they? And they leave the car kind of a bit further up the track. Interestingly, in reality, the house is actually quite near the gate, isn't it? And apparently they shot it from an angle to make it look as if it was a much further drive to get to the main house. So they've parked sort of somewhere in between, and then they get out and start walking around the grounds. Sarah suggests they go in the front, but the doctor says, "No, not this time, we'll take the back door." And then they hear a couple of guards approaching, and they kind of hide, and then the doctor decides he's going to brazen it out, and they start walking nonchalantly across the garden, don't they? And these two guards see them and shout out a warning, and then they break into a run, don't they, the doctor and Sarah, and they sort of run through a door into another part of the garden. The guards do open fire, but they managed to get away. And then we get a bit, they're sort of running around for a bit, being chased by these guards, and eventually they run into Scorby, don't they? The doctor says, "Get our hands up."
Yes.
And Scorby shouts out to the guards, who sort of catch up with them. And the doctor again says, "That's right, grab us, we're very dangerous."
And grab them they do, and they're taken before Chase. And the doctor helpfully introduces Scorby and the guards to Chase, which is quite amusing. But then he suddenly goes serious, and despite having Scorby's gun at his head, the doctor asks Chase demands that Chase hands over the pod. Chase politely refuses, doesn't he? He says he has the greatest collection of plants in the world, and when the crinoid pod flowers, it will be his crowning achievement. He then says he's going to execute them, and Sarah kicks up a fuss, doesn't she? And the doctor says, "Well, be reasonable, Sarah. What choice has he got? We keep interfering." And then grins. Chase, in true sort of Bond villain style, says before he executes them, they'll give them the privilege of seeing his plant collection, which is similar to inviting a girl in to see your etchings, I think.
Or your Doctor Who collection.
Yeah, but that one never works.
No.
You said it from experience.
Yeah, and he starts to show them around. He explains that the West Wing was built by Sir Boswell Chase in 1587, just before his execution. The doctor says, "Are we near the end? I do so hate guided tours."
Yeah, that's brilliant.
And eventually they end up in the plant laboratory. Oh, there's another good line as well about is it Chase that says irregular light patterns can affect the senses of so-called mindless things. The doctor says, "Oh yes, like Scorby here." which Scorby isn't particularly impressed with, is he?
No, he gets his revenge a bit late.
Yeah.
But, the doctor asks where Keeler is, and Chase says he's working on the pod. And we cut to Keeler working on the pod. He notes that the pod is changing and growing, and he tells Hargreaves, the butler, to go and fetch Chase.
And then we get to the scene where Chase is playing organ music to the plants. Some quite dreadful organ music, isn't it?
And it's a primitive synthesizer, isn't it?
Yeah. The doctor's doesn't try to disguise the fact that he thinks it's awful either, does he? Chase is saying that he composed some of the music himself. The doctor whispers something to Sarah, who says, what? He says, I said, the music's terrible.
Yes, he's playing his self-composed Hymn of the Plants.
Yeah.
And despite the Doctor's comments that Chase is under 10, in fact, Chase, the Doctor says a lot of facetious things to Chase, and most of the time he just kind of ignores them, doesn't he? He just carries on. And he does again at this point, and he goes on to play his Floriana Requiem.
Yeah.
Dedicated to Linnaeus, who was apparently a chap who devised the taxonomic system for classifying plants. Then Chase comes up with one of his classic camp lines, doesn't he, at this point? You know, Doctor, I could play all day in my green cathedral.
I don't know how he managed to deliver that with a straight face, but he does just about pull it off, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Absolutely superb.
Anyway, Hargreaves comes in at this point, doesn't he? And he tries to get Chase's attention. And the Doctor says, can't you see Mr. Chase is busy? tells him to go away, isn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, eventually Chase stops playing and asks him what he wants. And he says that Keeler needs him.
There's an interesting thing here. Hargreaves is played by a chap called Seymour Green. And if you are Chase's butler, you're going to see more green than the average butler, I would have thought. Ho-ho!
Yes, yes. Thanks for that.
Apparently, any time. I'm here all week. Apparently Seymour Green later appeared in the Twin Dilemma as one of those sort of bird people. You can't really, the actor must have noticed quite a difference between Seeds of Doom and the Twin Dilemma when he was acting in the boat.
Are you sure about that? I think you should go away and watch the Twin Dilemma just to make sure that that's correct.
Don't make me do that.
Maybe in a couple of podcast time.
You'll do that one on your own.
It's my choice, the one after next, isn't it?
It is. Oh, God.
Anyway, Chase tells Scorby to take the Doctor and Sarah away. He says, I'm sure they won't mind a few minutes delay before they die.
Another Bond line, isn't it?
Yeah. And then he goes off to see Keeler, and Keeler tells him that pod's started to grow. And he's getting a bit in a flap again, isn't he? Saying that they should stop it. But Chase has none of it, and he tells him to inject another 15 grams of the nitrogen, doesn't he?
Yes, bad idea, I think. Yes, meanwhile, Scorby's escorting the Doctor and Sarah through the grounds, but the Doctor manages to overpower him with a punch in the guts, and then quite a violent neck twist, doesn't he? With accompanying sound.
Very amusing.
Very funny, a bit undoctorish.
Yeah.
But kind of a chase sequence takes place, and then eventually the Doctor finds some rope and lowers Sarah down the exterior wall so she can go out of the grounds and warn Sir Colin. Quaintly, in 1975, when this was filmed, the Doctor says, have you got a 2p piece so she can put the coin in the phone box and use it? And the Doctor decides he's going to return to examine the pod. Of course, Sarah gets captured before she makes it out the grounds. And this guard makes quite the most of his bit part, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He sort of grabs her and says, one word out of you and you're a dead little girl. This is not a strange thing to call her. Yeah.
The Doctor's made his way back into the house and the guards bring Sarah to Scorby, who asks where the Doctor is, and he kind of grabs her and pushes her into the house. Meanwhile, the Doctor makes his way to the roof. He goes through kind of an attic, comes out onto the roof, and there's a kind of a skylight that looks down into the laboratory where Chase and Keeler are with the pod. He's, Doctor watches as Scorby brings Sarah into the room, and they start to sort of question her as to where the Doctor is. She's having none of it. She's just shuts up and won't say anything. Scorby tries putting a gun to her head, but Chase has got a better idea. He actually kind of grabs her and puts her arm out on the table by the pod. Basically tells Keeler to go and fetch some clamps to clamp her arm down to the table. Keeler's quite horrified at this. He says it's inhuman. But Chase says he doesn't care, that he must know what happens when a crinoid touches human flesh. And as the Doctor watches from above, the horrified Sarah sees the pod begin to open. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, brilliant cliffhanger.
Fantastic.
Absolutely superb. And then part four was actually broadcast on my 8th birthday. The 21st of February 1976 it came out.
Yes.
So I imagine I was watching on my birthday. Probably wearing my new Tom Baker underpants.
Well, the old pair had already worn out, had they?
Yeah, well, I had those on my head.
Yeah, actually, I've got really quite strong memories of this story from watching it when I was a kid as well.
It sticks in the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially the bit at the end of the story with the with the full-grown crinoids looming over the house. I remember that really.
Right. So,
but we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We are indeed. Yes, back to the beginning of part four. The doctor jumps through the skylight, or jumps through. Tom Baker jumps through some sugar glass, basically. Yeah. But stunt at the other end, as you see, the Dr. Land is by Terry Walsh, who apparently jumps 8 feet onto the floor there. But the Dr. Lands punches Scorby in the guts and smashes a wooden stool over his head. Then he nicks Scorby's gun, which he points at Chase.
Yeah.
Chase says, "What do you do for an encore, Doctor?" And the Doctor says, "I win." Grabs Sarah, and they rush out the door, locking Chase and the others in. It's a superb action-packed sequence, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, Chase bangs on the door, calling out for his guards. And he refers to being surrounded by idiots, which he says about 4 or 5 times this story, doesn't he?
And it becomes a bit of a catchphrase, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Meanwhile, distracted by what's going on, Keeler has left his arm a bit near the pod, hasn't he? And the pod has opened, and the frond grabs him, and he is crinoided.
Oh, that's got a smart, isn't it?
Exactly. Chase and Scorby kind of rush over to him to help him. Scorby maybe to help him, Chase just to see what's going on over there. One of the guards kind of opens the door and comes in, and Scorby kind of rushes out, and they're going off to look for the Doctor and Sarah. They've got outside, haven't they? And the Doctor kind of hides Sarah in this kind of alcove underneath the house, doesn't he?
Mm.
He tells her to stay there, or he says he must get another look at that pod. He's still got Scorby's pistol, and Sarah says, "You'll never use it." He says, "Well, I know that, but they don't, do they?" So he sort of sets off, leaving her there.
Yes. Meanwhile, Keeler's going a bit green about the gills, isn't he?
Yeah.
He begs Chase to take him to hospital, but Chase is obviously far more fascinated with the process than he is in saving Keeler's life. He calls for Hargreaves, and they both drag Keeler to the nearby cottage, the grounds.
The Doctor's managed to sneak back in, hasn't he? But as he passes this kind of alcove, Scorby comes out behind him with a semi-automatic and starts following him, doesn't he? The Doctor goes back into the lab, and as he goes in, he says, "Nobody move," but there's actually nobody in there, is there? And he sees that the pod has opened, but there's obviously nobody around. Scorby creeps into the room behind him. The Doctor has actually put his gun down on a sort of a nearby cabinet, hasn't he, as he walked in. And Scorby sort of says, predictable as ever, criminal returning to the scene of the crime. The Doctor just nonchalantly just kind of ignores him, really, and says, starts asking him about the pod. And he tells him that he's working for a madman. Scorby says, "Yeah, well, but he pays well. And when it comes to money, they're of the same religion." Scorby says the Doctor and Miss Smith aren't going to get out alive. Basically, hurls the Doctor out of the room. And he takes him down to the, there's a, like a composting room, isn't there? Presumably down in the basement somewhere. And he takes him into this room. And he basically just throws him into these dustbins, doesn't he?
Yeah, he really roughs him up, doesn't he?
Yeah. And,
looks like it's probably quite painful for Tom Baker as well.
Yeah, he kind of pushes him into the dustbin, and, Tom Baker kind of falls over him and then gets up again, and Scorby grabs him again and then pushes him down again.
"You're a bit unsteady on your feet, Doctor."
The Doctor says, "You're pushing your luck, Scorby." But Scorby shows him this machine, it's the composting machine, and he demonstrates the crusher to him, doesn't he, as the Doctor looks on.
Yeah, with a very grim expression on his face, as you might imagine. Yes. Meanwhile, back in the cottage, Chase and Hargreaves have got Keeler strapped to a bed on the upper floor, and they're just kind of sitting there observing him. Chase believes that the plant is absorbing protein from Keeler's body, or as he describes it, from the animal. But he thinks extra food will soon be needed, and they both leave to get some monitoring equipment.
Interestingly, Keeler can still speak, can't he? Because slightly inconsistent with what happened to Winlet, who seemed to be comatose as soon as the plant got him. But Keeler's more aware, isn't he?
He is, yeah. Which is worse for him, really.
He actually tries to appeal to Hargreaves to let him go, doesn't he? But Hargreaves obviously is too scared of Chase.
Yeah, Hargreaves throughout is just a real yes man, isn't he, for Chase? All this terrible stuff goes on, and he just goes along with it, doesn't he?
Back inside the main house, Scorby tells Chase that the doctor's safely locked in the fertilizer room. And then a call comes through from the main gate, and apparently Amelia Dukar is there. She's turned up because Chase owes her money. And you get a shot of the guard by the gate with the cross-eyed old bat looking on. And he tells Chase that she's mentioned lawyers. Chase says, well, you better bring her up to the library then.
Meanwhile, Sarah's gone into the cottage and she hears a sound of Keela groaning upstairs. So she creeps upstairs and opens the bedroom door and is horrified to see, you know, the state that Keela is in. An interesting note here is that Elizabeth Sladen asked not to see Mark Jones in full makeup until filming that scene. So she'd have a more authentic reaction, which is nice, and she does look suitably shocked.
Yeah.
Keela obviously tries to convince her to free him. He says he'll help her look for the doctor. But as he's saying that, it's a really creepy couple of flicks of his tongue as he's talking to her. It's really effective that you think that, you know, he's really been taken over, he's become quite a sinister sort of creature. And then when she basically says, well, yeah, you'll kill me, you might not want to, but you won't be able to stop yourself. And he grows really angry and starts shouting. And Sarah can hear Hargreaves coming up the stairs, so she hides in a cupboard while Hargreaves presents Keela with a delicious plate of raw meat.
Yes. In the library, Amelia is sitting smoking by the fire, and her and Chase are discussing some Venezuelan plant that Dukar is painting for Lady Chandling. Basically, there's some small talk between the two of them, isn't it? That they eventually get round to the fact that Chase owes her money for the painting that he bought off her. And she says that it's 750 guineas plus inflation. Chase decides he's going to write her a cheque for around £1,000.
Well, she decides on the thousand, doesn't she?
Yes. Yeah.
She drives quite a hard bargain.
Scorby comes in at some point, doesn't he? And he starts to say something and then changes. You know, he obviously sees her and stops what he's saying and says something about, shall we start the recycling experiment?
Yeah, that's good. Some change of report.
Yeah. Chase says no, that he wants to be there to see it himself, and he asks Scorby to show Amelia out.
We get a little scene of Hargreaves leaving Keela's room and Sarah sort of creeping out behind him. And then we see Chase in the composting room, and he's basically gloating over the doctor about the doctor's imminent demise in the compost crusher. Mm. And to the doctor's horror, Chase reveals that he's been feeding Keela. Not a good thing to do.
Sarah has made her way back into the house, and she hears some voices and hides behind a suit of armour that's in the corridor, doesn't she? As Scorby is showing Amelia out. They have a bit of a discussion, don't they? She's asking about the house. She says this bit looks like it's an early 16th century, and Scorby is like, not really my strong point. But a guard turns up and, you know, wants to tell Scorby something. And basically he leaves Amelia while he takes the bloke outside to hear what he's got to say. And Sarah manages to get Amelia's attention. She tells her that the two of them are there and what's been going on. Scorby almost catches them in the act, doesn't he? But Sarah manages to hide again, and Scorby says he heard voices, but... Amelia manages to say that she quite often talks to herself, and then sort of says, is the exit this way? And they manage to leave.
We have another quick scene of the doctor bound and in the sort of hopper part of the crusher, waiting to be ground under the wheels, and Chase is continuing to gloat. And then we pick up with Amelia again. She leaves the grounds of Chase's mansion and enters a car where Sir Colin and Dunbar are, and tells him what Sarah said. Dunbar realises he's made a terrible mistake and says that they know him in there, and he's going to go in there and try and make amends for his error and get the doctor. He says to Sir Colin that if he doesn't return in half an hour, he should return to London and call UNIT.
Hargreaves, meanwhile, has returned to give some more food to Keela. But when he enters the room, he finds that Keela is now almost a fully fledged axon-like crinoid. And he basically drops the tray of food and rushes out of the room. And Keela manages to break the bonds and get up out of the bed.
Yeah, he's quite horrific now, isn't he, Keela? He's got sort of great big tentacles coming out of his head, isn't he? Mm. Nasty.
Yeah, pretty grotesque. Sarah, meanwhile, has crept down to the compost room, where she finds the doctor. She tries to climb in, to get him out, but he manages to sort of point it towards the controls to the machine. She actually presses the wrong button first, and the whole thing speeds up, doesn't it? Then she manages to get the correct button, and then she manages to get in and help to untie him. He says, "Oh, Sarah, it would have been such a waste."
Thanks very much. Back in the mansion, Dunbar arrives and orders Chase to abandon the experiment. As he's doing so, Hargreaves rushes in and reports Keela's advanced transformation and that he's about to escape. Dunbar says that this has gone far enough and he's going to get help, gun in hand. And he runs off and Chase shouts, "Scorby, get Dunbar!"
Yeah, then we see sort of Dunbar running around in the grounds, don't we? Sarah and Doctor return to find that Keela's gone. They rush down the stairs of the cottage. The Doctor grabs a sword off the wall, doesn't he? On the kind of mantle on the wall. And they also go into the grounds. Dunbar is sort of in the woods, and he runs basically straight into the crinoid, doesn't he? And he turns to run, manages to trip over as the crinoid advances. While we get a shot of Scorby and the guards approaching and the Doctor and Sarah approaching, as Dunbar tries to get up, he appears to be trapped by some of the vegetation that's grabbed his ankle, effectively. And the crinoid looms over him, and then we get another awful scream, which obviously the others all hear. Sarah bends down and picks up a branch. She and the Doctor come into the clearing to see the crinoid, and it kind of rears up and comes towards them, doesn't it, as the episode ends?
Yes.
What do you think of that bit?
Well, this is the first time we see a crinoid when it's gone beyond humanoid form. Mm. And it's actually a sort of a two-man tent affair in production terms. There's two people in there moving this great tent of a monster along. I think it's good, but I think, as always, it's a problem of how these things move. And as it's moving along, you kind of sort of see the bottom of it sort of shuffling through the leaves, and that doesn't quite convince, but I think it's quite an horrific creature.
Yeah, I agree. I think it looks good when it's still, but when it actually kind of moved towards them, I thought it was a bit comical, actually.
Yeah, so sort of shuffles very
quickly. Yeah, and you can see it kind of creasing in the middle as well. I didn't think it was that effective.
No,
nevertheless, as I say, when it's still, it looks reasonably good.
Yeah, an interesting point about the filming of this is they filmed this scene on Halloween night, 1975, and between takes, the cast kind of stayed in had a sort of green room in the cottage, Keela's cottage. And they used to entertain themselves with their ghost stories in front of a roaring fire, which is a nice image, isn't it?
Yeah. Part 5 starts with Scorby and the two guards arrive in the nick of time, really. They start firing at it, which distracts it enough for the Doctor and Sarah to run off. And all of them repair to the cottage, don't they, where they get inside and start to block the door. You can hear the crinoid outside, so it's obviously following them, thankfully off camera. Chase beeps on Scorby's radio, doesn't he? And he basically tells Scorby that he doesn't want the crinoid harmed. But Scorby tells him that it's now 8 foot and it's already killed Dunbar. But Chase is still having none of it. He says, people are replaceable. The crinoid is unique.
Yes.
The Doctor grabs the radio off Scorby at that point, doesn't he, and tries to reason with him. But basically Chase just hangs up. This is kind of the turning point for Scorby, really, isn't it? He realises that, he's in it over his head, and basically he's now scared for his own existence, isn't he?
Yeah, he can't hide behind Chase anymore because Chase is now doing stuff that Scorby doesn't like, isn't he? Yes. The doctor's saying that the crinoid will grow to about the size of St. Paul's Cathedral, which is 365 feet high. And then it will multiply itself 1,000-fold. You know, the planet's had it by that stage. Mm. And as if to prove the point, a tentacle comes smashing through the cottage window. And there are various attempts to deal with this tentacle, aren't there? Scorby shoots at it. Sarah sort of pushes the handle of an axe against it.
Yeah, she has it the wrong way round, doesn't she?
Yeah, she doesn't really hit it very hard either. And the doctor jabs it with his sword, and eventually he manages to drive it off. And then quite a strange thing happens. You suddenly hear the booming voice of the crinoid. Presumably at this stage it's using whatever is left of Keeler to speak. And it starts by asking the doctor to come out and join it. And when he doesn't get anywhere with that ploy, it then makes an offer to the others, saying that they will all be spared if they give the doctor to the crinoid. Mm. They have until daybreak to decide. But of course, Scorby is more than willing to give the doctor up right now. Until the doctor points out, and Sarah, that without the doctor, there is no chance. Shouted very angrily again from Tom Baker, there is no chance. He loses again at this point quite effectively.
Yeah. What did you think of that? Because I didn't like that at all, the fact that it spoke.
Nor do I. I think it's a mistake.
Yeah.
I think you can get round all this bit without doing that. I think with a few lines of script, you can carry the story forward without the criminal having to speak. And I think one of the future lines from Chase is really nice about what life would be without any humans and just the crinoids and plants in charge. And he's talking about, you know, this beautiful silent world. If you've got crinoids stomping about shouting, it's not going to be very silent.
No, I think that was a mistake. And it only happens there, really, doesn't it, as well? Because it doesn't speak anymore afterwards.
No, it ends up speaking sort of through Chase, doesn't it, later on. And maybe that's how they could have got around it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. That was a much more convincing thing for me, that they've kind of infected him and he's speaking for them. I just didn't like this bit, the fact that it spoke and it was trying to get them out. You know, it's one of the few things I don't like about it.
It gives the impression that it's a kind of reasoning, cunning creature, I suppose. I mean, up until now we've just seen it lumbering about killing people, haven't we? So I suppose it's helpful in that respect, but yeah, I think it still would have been better had it not spoken.
Anyway, they're trying to figure out how they're going to get out of the cottage because they're basically trapped in there. And the doctor asks Scorby if he can make a bomb. And Scorby says, I can make a Molotov cocktail. And the doctor says, yeah, that's a good idea. So he goes off to do that. Meanwhile, Amelia is in Sir Colin's office, isn't she? And they're waiting to hear from UNIT. And she wonders whether they should have gone back to the grounds. Sir Colin says that it's too dangerous. It's bizarre, this scene, isn't it? She's sort of saying that she used to be in the armed services and that she wouldn't be scared and this kind of thing.
It's used a man and AKAK gun.
That's right, yeah. We hear that the Brigadiers in Geneva, or probably more realistically, Nicholas Courtney was on holiday, or working elsewhere, but they've sent a Major Beresford, who should be with them very shortly. Amelia manages to insult civil servants, doesn't she? And Sir Colin points out that he's a civil servant, to which he says, well, you know exactly what I mean then.
Yes.
And as she kind of leaves, she sort of pokes her head back in and says, oh, you know, I'm available for any future assignments if you want me.
Yes, don't call us, love. We'll call you. It's funny what you're saying about Nicholas Courtney. Apparently, in the original script, UNIT's role was going to be very small right at the end. So Douglas Camfield, the director, thought it wasn't really worth getting Nicholas Courtney on board just for that. But as the script started to get fleshed out, UNIT's role got bigger. So they contacted Nicholas Courtney, but he was touring abroad, so he wasn't available anyway. So they introduced the character of Major Beresford in his place.
Oh, right. Chase is talking to Hargreaves, and he says he wants to take some pictures of an alien organism, so he's going to go outside. Hargreaves sort of is telling him to be careful, but Chase says that he's got nothing to fear from the crinoid. And you see the crinoid kind of lurking around outside, don't you? And then Dawn approaches, and basically Scorby has managed to put this Molotov cocktail together, hasn't he? The doctor wants to go back to the house to contact Sir Colin, and, you know, we're going to use this bomb to distract the crinoid while they get away. Scorby goes up to the roof to throw it, and throws the bomb at the crinoid. Apparently it's distracted, although it doesn't seem to have much effect, does it? They all run out. Chase is outside in the grounds, and he sees the crinoid rising above the house, doesn't he? And the doctor makes his way to the limo and drives off while the others all run to the main house, which disgusts Chase, who's watching them. The Doctor manages to drive off. The creature's following after him, isn't it? But he obviously gives up when he goes out of the main gate.
Yes. Meanwhile, Scorby's back at the house. He's trying to find Chase in his greenhouse, green cathedral there. And Hargreaves says that he's going to have to take photos. They begin barricading the windows, ready for the crinoid to attack. Scorby reckons the Doctor's basically run off and left them to their fate, and he won't be back to help them. But Sarah says, well, that's the kind of thing you would probably do, but the Doctor isn't going to. And they have a real sort of set to, don't they? And at which point Scorby looks like he's about to hit her, but then decides better against it, stomps off, and she looks quite relieved afterwards. She's quite a nice bit of acting from this lady.
Out on the grounds, Chase is taking pictures of the crinoid. It's watching him, isn't it? And then it starts to move towards him, and he starts talking to it. He calls it Keeler, doesn't he? And says that he wants to help it. He says, no, no, not me. I want to help. He's in quite a kind of sunlight, isn't he? And then you see the shadow of the creature as it obviously looms over him. You think it's going to kill him, but as we find out, I don't think it does.
Yes. Apparently those words were sort of improvised by Tony Beckley, who played Harrison Chase. Meanwhile, the Doctor's arrived at the Bureau as Major Beres was there warning Sir Colin that he can't mount a raid on private property without evidence. Tom Baker's in brilliant form in this scene, isn't he? He arrives and pushes an aide who's trying to stop him going in. He just pushes him out of the room. When he listens to Beres prevaricating about whether he's going to attack or not, he shouts waffle straight into his face. And he goes to plead with Sir Colin to take some action. While he does so, Sir Colin's phone rings, and the Doctor picks up the phone, shouts, he's busy, and slams it down. And so they eventually decide that it's worth doing something, don't they?
The Doctor says that there's a revolution going on, that all vegetation is about to turn hostile, and that somehow the crinoid can channel its power into other plants. Sir Colin jokes about aggressive rhubarb, doesn't he? And the homicidal gooseberries. But the Doctor basically shows them both a report, which basically backs up what he's just been saying. There's a 55-year-old gardener found strangled to death in a rose arbor. There's a cultural worker found strangled in a field, and something, another one I think there is as well. They all happened within a mile of Chase's estate. And when he says that, they obviously look a bit concerned. The Doctor says, shall we get started then, gentlemen?
Yes. Yeah, so he calls Sarah back at the mansion and tells her that Beresford's preparing to attack crinoid with a laser gun, which makes you think again that these things are set not exactly contemporaneously at the time, but a little bit into the future. So you know, got this laser gun that they're going to use in the crinoid. As they're talking over the phone, you see some vines creep up onto the roof and break the phone lines. They then bust through the window in front of Sarah, so the crinoid's really getting control of the local foliage, isn't it?
We then see Chase, who's lying on the ground in the gardens. He's in like a trance, isn't he? In like a euphoric state, I guess.
A bit sort of post-coital, isn't he?
Yes. And he's muttering to himself, isn't he? Saying that plants must win. And this is the bit you mentioned earlier. He refers to there being a new, silent and beautiful world.
It's quite a lovely piece of writing, that, I think. And it's very nicely delivered. And there's a kind of weird atmosphere to this scene, isn't there? And Chase obviously had some kind of weird epiphany, isn't he? And he's talking about this strange new world. It's really nice, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Back inside the lab, Scorby comes back in with some planks to help board up the windows and doors. And Sarah starts to tell him about the vines moving and all this kind of stuff. He's not convinced. And then some more vines smash through the window, don't they? Right in front of him. So I think that convinces him fairly.
Yeah.
Sarah tells Scorby that the Doctor's on his way back. And Hargreaves comes in and says all the guards have left. Scorby refers to them all being like a bunch of women, doesn't he? And Hargreaves says that he actually heard screams, but he didn't go out to check. So obviously the guards are no more. Sarah wants to go out and have a look, but, you know, Scorby says that'd be stupid. She sort of says, was it you just said about women? And she stalks out. And Scorby kind of reluctantly goes after her.
Yes. When they're out, they find a dead guard. He seems to have been absolutely smothered and choked by some vines. Chase arrives, still in his weird state, and tells him that the plant revolution is underway, and you know, basically it's a good thing. It's the plant's world, and humans are only parasites. Scorby finally realises that Chase is mad at this point. Chase goes off to the manor to develop his fascinating photographs. And then you see him in his sort of greenhouse area, sat cross-legged speaking to the plants surrounding him about the plant revolution. This is quite a creepy scene, isn't it?
Yeah, very creepy. Hargreaves kind of closes the doors on him, doesn't he, and sort of blocks the way as Scorby comes back in with Sarah. But, you know, Scorby kind of pushes him out of the way and goes in to try and reason with Chase. He shuts off the organ music that had been playing and starts almost kind of shaking him, doesn't he? But Chase is still ranting on about the harmony of root, stem, leaf, flower. He says, you know, animals have ruled for millions of years. It's now our turn. So, you know, the use of the word our is quite significant there, isn't it?
Yeah, he describes animals as the enemy, doesn't he?
Yeah. And Sarah says, oh, you hate us, don't you? He says, yes. It's only a matter of time before you will die. Hargreaves basically tells Scorby that Chase is ill and to leave him alone. But at that point, Sarah notices that the plants have started to move around them. So while Chase is sitting happily cross-legged, untouched, the plants start to engulf the other three, don't they?
Yes, and Chase is shouting at Scorby, don't resist us, Scorby, all plant eaters must die. And sure enough, the plants are setting about them. But not Chase, as you say.
At this point, there's one of the soldiers is at the gates of the house, and it's Sergeant Henderson. And he opens the gates to let the limo through, which the doctor's driving. And the doctor kind of picks up Henderson, and they drive up towards the house. Inside, Sarah, Scorby, and Hargreaves are now being strangled by these vines. The doctor and Henderson rush in through a side door, and they're carrying these kind of canisters, aren't they? And they actually shoulder the door open, don't they, and rush in and find the room where they all are. They start spraying the plants and the vines. Chase is absolutely furious, isn't he? He sort of comes up saying, you'll pay for this, animal fiends! He tries to kind of grab either Dr. Henderson, but they kind of shake him off. They manage to pull Sarah and Scorby out of the plants, don't they? They're still okay, but unfortunately Hargreaves has breathed his last.
Yes, the trusty old retainer has gucked it. Yeah, Chase has run off at this point, hasn't he? And the doctor and the others make their way out into the lab, and it turns out that what was in the canisters was a top-secret military defoliant. Unfortunately, it's run out. So they start moving the plants out to the courtyard under the doctor's instructions because he says they're the eyes and ears of the crinoid. So they start shifting all these plants out into this courtyard. But when they're all outside, Chase locks the door behind them. And Sarah sees the enormous crinoid at this point towering over the house and sort of looking down on them. Mm. And you see Chase with his back against the locked door, sort of smiling camply. And then the episode ends.
Yeah, that's the ending I remember from a kid, that massive crinoid looming over them. It's another good ending.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah.
I think some of the shots of the crinoid over the house are very good, and others not so, actually.
Yes.
Let me point that out as we get into the final part. Beresford and his men arrive, don't they, and they basically shoot this laser at the crinoid, which gives the doctor and friends the opportunity to leg it over to another door and manage to get back into the house. That's quite amusing, actually, because you know, one of his men's got the laser gun. Beresford shouts, "Far! Far!" in a really incredibly posh army voice.
It sounds a bit like Terry Thomas or something.
But anyway, the laser doesn't appear to do too much, but it does, I guess, distract it a bit. They hit it a few times, and then they realise it's not really doing a great deal, so they retreat. The doctor and the others are back in the lab again. The doctor says they need to find Chase before he has another bout of megalomania. They've got the crinoid outside, a madman lurking inside. Not a happy situation.
The doctor realises that Chase is possessed by the crinoid, and that's why the crinoid itself and the plants don't harm him. As they leave to look for Chase, Chase himself slips back into the laboratory and has a look at this defoliant and says, filth. Really disgusted look on his face, doesn't he? And then he goes over to the sort of radio system and smashes it up.
The doctor is also inside the house. He opens a door and to find vegetation behind it. He properly slams it again. Henderson comes up and he says that there's a creeper breaking into the corridor. So they decide they're going to go back and find Scorby. Outside, Beresford is telling Sir Colin that the laser was no good, and they're watching the giant crinoid, which is sitting on top of the house. You get this interim shot, which doesn't look very good, I think. And then we start getting the model shots of the crinoid, the slow motion-y type shots, which I think, are more effective.
Yes, they are. Yeah, the crinoid certainly looks better in those scenes, flapping its tentacles around.
Exactly. You get this sort of CSO one first, which is a bit ropey.
Yeah, so unable to find Chase, the others return to the laboratory, and the crinoid tries to break its way in again. Henderson decides he's going to get some more timber to barricade the windows over, try and keep the crinoid out, and he gives his gun to the doctor, who then hands it to Scorby, which is a sign of how relationship has changed, isn't it?
Mm.
And Scorby kind of looks at it with distaste and then sort of aims it at the window.
Yeah.
But as Henderson's out looking for this timber, you see him find some, and he's just walking along a corridor when Chase arrives and knocks him out with a rubber spanner.
Yeah, he hits him pretty violently with it, doesn't he? And sort of drags him off. You get another good bit here, I liked the effect, where the crinoid is obviously pushing down on the roof of the house and it starts breaking through the ceiling, doesn't it? You get
big
chunks of masonry falling down. And I think it looks very effective.
Yeah, it's a model shot as well.
It is. Yeah.
It looks very good.
Some more of the ceiling kind of falls down on the doctor and then onto Scorby, doesn't it? And that seems to be the final straw for Scorby, who's getting more and more frantic, and he's referring to the fact that he always looks after himself. He's always been a survivor. He's been out in Africa and the Middle East, and he's a mercenary, and he's ranting a bit, isn't he?
Interestingly, the doctor appears to be barely listening to Scorby as he's ranting. But the whole thing's suddenly got a bit sort of base under siege, hasn't it, with tempers getting a bit fractious, and Sarah sort of shouts Scorby down again. It's a nice sort of a dramatic scene between the characters. Meanwhile, there's a short scene where we see Chase put Sergeant Henderson in the compost machine and then turn it on. And then we're back again into this sort of anteroom next to the greenhouse where the plants are still trying to break through. The doctor has managed to repair the radio system that Chase has smashed up. But Scorby is sort of wallowing in self-pity at this stage, isn't he? He's sort of crouched down next to a table saying, "We're as dead as mutton." And then the crinoid attacks again, and at this point Scorby sort of has too much and just panics and makes a run for it.
Yeah, the doctor and Sarah try to stop him, but too late, he's outside. And you see him basically running through the trees and shrubs and vines, and they all seem to be lashing at him, don't they, as he gets through them. He seems to come out to a bit of a clearing. You think, well, maybe he's going to get away, but there's a little pond. And he runs blindly into this pond up to his chest, really, and he kind of wades through it. And then, quite horribly, the weeds in this pond rise up over him and drag him down and, you know, sort of disappears under the water.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the crinoid is now towering over the mansion. And I think that's the scene we're talking about, isn't it, where it starts using the model shots. And it looks pretty effective, I think, with the... There's loads of tentacles sort of moving quite well, I think.
Yeah, and you get it kind of knocking bits of, you know, masonry off the house, don't you, and things like that. It's very impressive model shots throughout, I think.
Yeah, they are. Very good. The doctor has sorted out this radio system, and he needs Beresford's wavelength so they can contact him. So Sarah goes off to find Sergeant Henderson. She makes her way to the compost machine room, and Chase is behind the door, and he shuts it, and he's in there with her, and she can't escape. He's telling her that he's become part of the plant world thanks to the crinoid. He refers to humanity as parasites. And then quite alarmingly, there's a bit just at the end of the scene where he looks like he's about to give her an almighty whack, and then the scene ends, isn't it?
Yes, he kind of looms towards her as if he's about to strike her, doesn't he?
Yeah, with a very unpleasant look on his face.
Yeah. And we find out she's unconscious the next time we see her, so he obviously did.
I find that quite shocking every time I see that.
Yeah, it's quite strong, isn't it?
Mm.
Beresford is calling for backup, I think, on the radio, but instead he manages to get hold of the doctor, who says the situation's desperate. They've only got about 15 minutes before the crinoid reaches the primary point of germination. So Colin asks what that means, and the doctor says that at that point the crinoid will eject hundreds of spores, embryo pods, which, you know, will then scatter around the whole planet, and the planet will be doomed. And the doctor thinks that the only thing they can do now is to order an aircraft attack with high explosives to basically destroy the crinoid and the house. And he says, get onto it. We've only got 15 minutes.
He sort of heroically tells them that it doesn't matter that he and Sarah are in the house, you know, just get on with the airstrike anyway, which is, I think, very brave on Sarah's behalf, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, 15 minutes to live, I think it's probably worth the risk.
Well, maybe. You know, maybe they get out in that time. But anyway, you then see some stock footage of some phantom jets with some sort of jingoistic music going on in the background.
Yes, rubbish music. But Chase has tied the unconscious Sarah up and put her in the machine. And he actually starts the machine, and Sarah starts to move towards the whirring teeth. She actually comes round from her unconscious state and starts to struggle. And then the doctor bursts into the room. He shoves Chase into these bins again, doesn't he? And he stops the machine, jumps in, and starts untying Sarah. He manages to get her legs untied, doesn't he? But not her arms. And he kind of picks her up and puts her outside of the machine, at which point Chase jumps on him, and he restarts the machine, and then he and the doctor have this struggle, don't they? And they both end up inside the machine, moving towards the whirring teeth. They're struggling away. The doctor manages to climb out, and then Chase is grabbing his arm. But he obviously then starts to get drawn in to these teeth of the grinder. The doctor seems to be trying to help him out, but Chase is more interested in pulling him back in, and eventually he lets out his awful cry, and obviously he goes through the grinder. Pretty grim, but you don't see much, do you?
No, you see that after he's gone through, you even see the blades, and there's no blood or anything, but it's pretty strong meat anyway. Yeah. All this time, Sarah's been trying to turn it off, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's been kind of hopping up and down, but her arms are still tied behind her back, so she can't reach that.
So they're both, in a way, trying to save Chase's life at the end, but all Chase is interested in doing is trying to pull the doctor in with him, which is a sign of the man, or the plant, I suppose, as you might say by that stage.
Yes.
Outside the house, the RAF have launched a sighting run on the house, and Beresford and Sir Colin are looking through binoculars to see any sign of the doctor. Sarah and the doctor are trying to get out, but there's plant life covering the house. The doctor manages to get a steam pipe off the wall, and Sarah opens the door and he blasts some steam into the foliage that's outside the door, and this gives them some sort of passage to let them at least start on their way out.
Wasn't so, particularly well done though, was it?
Bit of a lack of steam, isn't it?
Yeah. It didn't but, seem to have made a great deal of difference.
No, but they end up doing what Scorby did and kind of bash their way through all those leaves and vines and stuff. But then they find a kind of clearing with loads of cut down trees, don't they? So they're safe there. As the RAF, you know, launch their attack proper and basically blow up the crinoid and the mansion quite spectacularly.
Yeah, you get some good shots. First one hits the house and blows chunks of masonry out up into the air. The second one hits the crinoid, doesn't it? Yeah. And then you get a big blast where things are flying everywhere. The doctor and Sarah pop their heads up from behind this log and watch as the place is engulfed in flames. The flames at the end are a bit too big, aren't they? But other than that, it all looks good.
Yeah, that's the curse of the model explosion, isn't it? But yeah, all in all, it's a good effort, isn't it?
And then suddenly we're back in Sir Colin's office, where he is asking the doctor if they've seen the last of the crinoid. And the doctor says, well, the Intergalactic Floral Society, of which naturally I'm the president, find it very difficult to study the crinoids because their researchers tend to disappear. Sir Colin says that the Royal Horticultural Society want the doctor to address one of their functions. The doctor says, asked him when it is. He says, oh, it's the 15th. He goes, ah, no, sorry, I'm fully booked for the next 2 centuries, but any time after that would be fine.
Yeah, no, Sir Colin doesn't quite know what to make of that, does he? Yeah. So the doctor says to Sarah that they need a holiday and he's going to take her to Cassiopeia. Unfortunately, the TARDIS materialises in Antarctica, the doctor having forgotten to reset the coordinates. Mm. Sarah comes out in a beach outfit and a beach ball and, you know, clearly not appropriate attire for the conditions. Mm. And there's a kind of strange ending, isn't there? They both sort of say in unison, have we been here before? Are we yet to come? And they both sort of laugh like maniacs.
I mean, I did. I was falling off the sofa when I was when I saw that.
That's a cracker, isn't it? But there's a slight issue, isn't there? They didn't actually use a TARDIS to go to Antarctica. They went in a chopper, didn't they? Apparently there is a line explaining that they got cut in that they had set up all the coordinates to go via TARDIS and then they decided that it would be kind of less obtrusive and suspicious if they actually went by the chopper instead, which would have explained away that inconsistency.
Yes, I hadn't actually noticed that, but you're right. They didn't go there, did they? Never mind. No. But yeah, well, that's it. I thought it was a little bit of an anticlimax, the ending, really, because they just blew it up. And after all the build-up, I thought it was just a little bit of a feeble resolution. Might have made a little bit more sense if they'd have used the defoliant on a bigger scale, if they'd have used explosives with this defoliant in it or something.
I mean, I agree with you. It is a little bit of a cop-out, I think, because the Doctor really doesn't have any involvement in that, and it's always better if the Doctor, or at least his companion, is instrumental in the defeat of the enemy. You could almost take the Doctor and Sarah out of this, and if Dunbar and Sir Colin had been keeping their eye on what was happening, they could have arranged all this themselves without any intervention from the others.
Well, I'm not quite so sure about that, really. I mean, the Doctor, yeah, he's not flying the plane or anything like that, but he does suggest that that's what they need to do. And throughout the story, it is him that discovers, that it's Chase.
If Dunbar was going to turn anyway, then he knows all that stuff. He knows it's Chase, and he will know about the pod, and they already know that the pod is dangerous from what the team at the camp have radioed back to them. So if Dunbar was keeping his eye on what was going on and decided it had gone too far and spoken to Sir Colin about it, Sir Colin would have sorted Beresford out, and I'm sure at some point Beresford has said, well, let's do an airstrike, because nothing else has worked. So in a way, it could have happened without any intervention from the Doctor, but it would have been an interesting... But that's nitpicking. But, I would like to have seen something more Doctorish happening at the end to defeat the crinoid.
Nevertheless, it's still a cracker.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It does feel a little bit rushed at the end, and I say it's too easy at the end.
Mm.
Shame. But anyway, overall, other than that, what do you think?
Well, it's superb, isn't it? Yeah. It really is an absolute cracker. It's one of the best ideas, I think, in the show's history, isn't it? The killer plant and plant life taking over on Earth, I think, is quite a chilling idea. It's a game of two, not quite halves, isn't it? You've got the first two parts in Antarctica and the final parts in England, haven't you? But they're both excellent and they both work really well together, I think.
Yes, I loved all the Antarctic stuff. I thought that was done really well. And it is a clean break, isn't it, at the end of part two? And then everything else when they're back in England.
Well, they often say, don't they, that six-parters are normally a two and a four stuck together, but this is perhaps a little reverse, because it's often a four-parter with a two-parter in the end, whereas this is in reverse.
It's almost like the first two parts were kind of the prelude, aren't they?
Yes.
Quite extended prelude, but nevertheless.
Yes, see what the crinoid could do and then see it down your high street, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a really strong story. We've already talked about the model shots in it, which I think work really well. The creature itself, with a couple of minor bits where it doesn't look particularly realistic, like when it's shuffling around, and a couple of CSO shots. But other than that, I think it's very effective. In all its stages, when Keeler and Winlet are starting to change, and when they're in kind of mid-term, if you like.
That provides some real jumps and shocks, doesn't it, when you see how far they're advanced each time.
Yeah.
It's really good stuff.
The Doctor's brilliant in it, although he is far more violent than we see him ever again, before or after, isn't he?
Yeah, he's much more of a sort of a traditional action hero in this one, isn't he?
Yeah.
And that's probably a lot to do with Robert Banks Stewart, the writer, isn't it? Because he worked on The Sweeney and The Avengers and Callan and stuff like that before and after this. So he's writing it from that kind of stance, isn't he? Without perhaps being quite so steeped in what the Doctor is like as a character. But there's enough stuff in there, perhaps from Robert Holmes' script editing, there's enough in there to make him Doctorish as well. So it's just the Doctor being a bit more violent than usual, but still the Doctor, isn't it? It's quite surprising, some of the stuff he gets up to, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, other than the fact that he's punching people and, all the stuff he does with Scorby, he's very much the Doctor. The rest of his traits are exactly in line with what he normally does. But it's just that extra bit. You see him with a gun, and he seems quite comfortable with the gun, which he doesn't normally seem to be, does he?
No, he doesn't tend to hold one for very long, does he? Yeah. Tom Baker and Elizabeth Sladen, I think, are both on absolute top form in this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as characters, I think they work really well as a team, don't they?
Yes, fantastic. I mean, one of the best TARDIS teams of all time, definitely.
Mm. And there's a lot of kind of teamwork here that gets them through the scrapes throughout this story.
Yes. Guest cast is fantastic. John Challis is superb. He takes the kind of henchman role to a new level, I think. You normally get a fairly one-dimensional role for the henchman, don't you, in most of these stories. But I think he's quite rounded.
Yeah, he is, and it's nice to have a bit of backstory for him as well, and good to see that he doesn't just blindly obey his master. He's out for himself pretty much throughout, isn't he?
I think Chase, as we've said, is very camp. and a megalomaniac, and I think he just about gets away with it without overacting too much.
I think he's brilliant, Tony Beckley. I think he's superb. I think he's one of the best ever chief villains, I think. Yeah. It's unusual, isn't he? In his sort of campness, it's unusual. He's very sort of urbane, isn't he, with Amelia Dukar and all that kind of stuff. I don't think those scenes, some of the people consider those scenes with her as padding, but I don't think they are, because you see another side of Chase, and she also has a part to play in the plot as well. But you see Chase, you know, as probably other people see him outside of the mansion when he's going about his business. Yes. And then you see him at home, you know, absolutely a mental case, isn't he? Yeah. But the thing about him is he feels very unpredictable, unlike a lot of Doctor Who villains. You never quite know what he's going to do next, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I thought he was great, but I just think a couple of occasions he goes a little bit too far. Yeah, Green Cathedral bit, for instance.
I love that.
Yeah, I love it, but I just think it's a bit much.
Walking the line, isn't it?
But yeah, I mean, he's a great villain. I think Keeler's fantastic.
Yes.
Great performance. Guys at the base, I can't think of a bad performance in it, really.
I think they're all great. Even Amelia's, you know, quite good fun, and it's,
yeah,
it's a bit of light relief, but it works.
Dunbar is convincing, you know, and Sir Collins. Collins a bit, I guess he's, of all of them, he's probably the most one-dimensional.
Yeah.
But he's fine, you know, he's a good performance. So.
Onto the sort of, the kind of feel of it. The direction, I think, is fairly sort of unshowy, isn't it? Workmanlike, in a good way.
Yeah.
But I think the editing is really good.
Yeah.
I think it really leads to quite a pacey feel, because you'll get very quick scenes just progressing certain characters along, intercut with each other, so you're keeping up with everybody without having to have long scenes with each of them. And that really leads to a good feeling of pace.
Mm. Yeah, but it's a six-parter, and yet I don't think there's a lot of padding in there, really.
No.
There's a little bit of a runaround, I guess, in part 3 and 4. But I didn't think when I was watching it, oh, there's no need for that. As you say, it rattles along and it builds up really well to the finale. So, you know, it fills the six parts extremely well.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't seem to drag at all, does it?
No.
What about the incidental music? We said we didn't like the bit behind the stock footage of the Phantom Jets that much, but I think the rest of it is absolutely superb.
Yep. Totally. It's
Jeffrey Bergen, isn't it, who did only one other incidental score for the series, and that was, and as I said at the top of the podcast, was The Terror of the Zygons. There's a little kind of woodwind in there, isn't it? Flutes and stuff, and nice bits of cello here and there. It's really atmospheric, as I remember Terror of the Zygons being as well. I think he works very well in Doctor Who, and it's a shame, really, that he only did two stories, I think.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Unfortunately, just before this DVD was released, I think a few months ago, Mark Jones, who played Keeler, died. And then quite recently, Jeffrey Bergen died as well. Luckily, on the DVD, they've managed to have an interview with him talking about his music for the show. So that was done just in time.
That's nice.
The overall atmosphere, I think, is very nicely autumnal, isn't it? It's a great one to watch at this time of year, really.
Yeah, it was by chance that it's been released at that time. But you're right, it does feel this is the right kind of time to be watching Doctor Who, as we've said before.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, yeah, as you say, it's a cracker. And up there with the best of them, I reckon.
Yeah, I think so. We've got a little bit of feedback. Got some from my brother, Rob, again. He says, how different from most other Doctor Who stories of that era. It seemed to have more in common with those 1960s ITC shows, like The Saint and The Avengers, etc. What with double-dealing suitcases of cash, people being driven to a disused quarry in a Daimler, all that smashing of equipment and loads of violence. The Doctor seems to be pretty handy in a fight, in a Simon Templar sort of way, and Boyce was brilliant. Chase was supremely creepy. A brilliant story. Agree with all that, I think?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And that's another thing about the incidental music. It makes you feel a little bit more like those ITC shows that Rob's talking about, whereas Deadly Dudley Simpson, you always know it's Doctor Who you're watching, don't you? Not that I've got anything against him, because he's brilliant as well, but this added to the extra difference in feeling.
Yeah, it's nice to have somebody fresh on the show, isn't it? So no matter how good somebody is, new blood is always good, isn't it?
Yes.
We have some more feedback from regular listener Wayne Peters. Wayne says that it's most definitely his favourite Doctor Who story of all. He loves everything about it. he says that for many years he described it as a Doctor Who does Lovecraft, but nowadays sees so much more in it, not least The Thing from Another World, later remade as John Carpenter's Thing, and a Quatermass Experiment. He says proper monster in the house body horror, first in the isolation of the Antarctic and later in the spooky Gothic mansion. Insane multi-millionaire Bond-style villain, yeah. Tom Baker on top form as a Doctor. Treacherous humans who are more dangerous to each other than crinoid is. Can't get enough of it. Even the crinoid itself, whilst clearly a rubber suit stroke tent, still works for me. The model shot the full-size crinoid on top of the house as the RF nuke it, whilst obviously a model, still works particularly well. Yeah, I'd agree with that. As we said earlier, I think those shots are excellent. One of his most distinct childhood memories is where they're holding Sarah's arm near the pod and it begins to open. That cliffhanger stuck with him for 35 years.
Yeah, that's the thing about this story. There's a number of cliffhangers that really stick with you.
Yeah, and that's obviously a sign of a good story, that you can remember it from when it was actually shown.
Yeah, definitely.
He says the only oddity for him is the new action Doctor, which, you know, the point that we were making. Just running, jumping and fighting, and even carrying a gun. Not that that spoils it for him. It may be out of character, but not generally so. Yeah. And there's a lot more there, which you can find on our Facebook page in the discussion section. So thanks for your comments, Swain.
Yeah, so time we rated it, don't you think?
Yes. Shall I go first this time? 9 out of 10 for me. I think it's one of the top Doctor Who stories, one of Baker's best. Doesn't quite get full marks, really, just because the ending, I think, lets it down a little bit. I'd give it 9.5 if I could, but we don't give halves. And you?
I'd really like to give it a 10, but I'm going to go for a 9 as well, simply because what you said, really. Well, there's two things that we mentioned, really. One is I find the crinoid talking quite jarring, really.
Yeah.
And I wish they hadn't done that. And, as I said, I would like to have seen a more Doctor-based, cleverer resolution to the story, rather than, you know, just UNIT taking over and blowing it to bits. Mm. But that said, it's immensely enjoyable 6 parts, I think.
Definitely.
I could watch it again and again, and will now I've got the DVD. So it's a real cracker, and I think it's one that you could introduce people to Classic Who with as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of, even with the effects. You know, if you compare it to Ark in Space with the effects in that, which you did have to kind of suspend your disbelief with the bubble wrap, this one, it's much more realistic, you know, and done far better, I think. The combination of costume and model shots, I think, just works superbly.
Yeah, it does. As I've said, everyone's on top form, and the effects are, you know, relatively good. And it's exciting stuff. It's very close to a 10 out of 10.
Very close, but not quite there.
So, yes, there we go, Seeds of Doom. Clearly, we've got some vested interest in this story, as we named our podcast after the crinoid pod. So nice to have been able to discuss it on this podcast. And thanks for the feedback. If anyone has got any other feedback on this story, there's still time to let us know, because we can mention it at the beginning of the next podcast. Contact us our usual places, please, via email at crinoid@mail.com, via the blog site at crinoid.blog.co.uk. Look us up on Facebook. We are Crinoid. We can use the link on the left-hand side of the blog page to get to our Facebook area. And you can follow or tweet us on Twitter. We are Crinoid on Twitter. So we'd love to hear from you via any or all of those means.
Good stuff. Well, there's one thing left for us to do, Jim.
Yes, we haven't forgotten about the requests for other stories for us to cover. Please keep them coming. There's an area in the discussions section of Facebook. Because of the ones that we've done and the other sort of requests we've already been through, and the fact that we don't want to repeat doctors or themes too close together, we're rather selfishly going for another choice of our own this time. And it's me this time. And we're going to go back to the patchy world of Colin Baker.
Cool.
And the December podcast will be Attack of the Cybermen.
Ah, good choice.
Yes, it's a suitably wintry story, I think, for December.
Yes, I guess it is, yes. That'll be an interesting one.
Yes, we haven't done Colin Baker for a little while, so we thought it's time to drag him out again. So, yeah, any thoughts on Attack of the Cybermen, then please use those methods to contact us. We'll be putting up a discussion on it in the discussion section on Facebook again as well. So in the near future, you'll be able to put any remarks you have about the show on there.
Yes, sir.
So, once again, thanks very much for listening and or downloading us. And we hope to have your company next time. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next time.
Have we been here before?
Or
are we yet to come?
Thank you.